like to turn to the book of Joshua, chapter number 8. The book of Joshua, chapter number 8. And I want to look at something. Wow, you feel fancy with all this. Either that or trying to booby trap me.
You got to watch out. Careful
now. But Joshua chapter 8, and I wanted to talk a little bit on how Israel actually came in and possessed the land and the conquest of the land. But at the same time, I want to show some parallels between Joshua's conquest of the land and the Ecclesia's conquest in the celestial realms. I think, hopefully, if it goes according to plan, it'll be an interesting study. So, Joshua chapter number 8, verse number 1. And the Lord said unto Joshua, fear not, neither be thou dismayed. Take all the people of war with thee, and arise, go up to Ai. See, I have given into thy hand the king of Ai, and his people, and his city, and his land. And thou shalt do to Ai and her king as thou didst unto Jericho and her king. Only the spoil thereof and the cattle thereof shall ye take for a prey unto yourselves. Lay thee in ambush for the city behind it. So Joshua arose and all the people of war to go up against Ai. And Joshua chose out 30,000 mighty men of valor and sent them away by night. And he commanded them, saying, behold, ye shall lie in wait against the city, even behind the city. Go not very far from the city, but be ye all ready. And I and all the people that are with me will approach unto the city, and it shall come to pass, when they come out against us, as at the first, that we will flee before them. For they will come out after us, till we have drawn them from the city, and they will say, they flee before us as at the first, therefore we will flee before them. Then ye shall rise up from the ambush and seize upon the city, and the Lord your God will deliver it into your hand. I want to stop there. If you're familiar with the book of Joshua, what had happened the first time is Israel had attacked this city, but they didn't do it the way that God had instructed them. And this small little city actually defeated the Israeli army, and the Israeli army actually fled before the army of Ai. And they, you know, some things ensued. God did some things as he communicated information to Joshua. You had a really interesting dynamic on somebody who had disobeyed God, and a sentence was imposed upon that individual and his family. And God said, well, don't be dismayed, Joshua. I'm going to give the city into your hand, and this is what you're going to do. And I kind of diagrammed what he was talking about. You had a base camp here, and you had a camp over here not far from what we know as Bethel. Ai's here. There's a valley over here. And what they would do with the base camp is they would actually send a large segment of their force in behind the city. And he would come. The main group would come out towards the valley. And the idea was that the Ai army would come out and engage them. And as they're being engaged, the main force would flee, and this group would actually come in and take the city. That's the plan. Now, keep that in mind, and we'll look at it, because the battle's going to be fought over here, and we'll look at that in a minute. If you want to go with me, though, you don't have to stay in Joshua. But if you want to go to the book of Deuteronomy for a second. Deuteronomy chapter number 11. And verse 21. Says here that your days may be multiplied in the days of your children and the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers to give them, is the days of heaven upon the earth. Now, it's interesting because Israel's conquest of the land was how God was going to bring nations that were in rebellion against him under his authority. And God began a plan. We know there was a rebellion, and it was led by Satan. And it's interesting because after that rebellion, in Genesis chapter number 1, between verse 1 and verse 2, there's a judgment that ensued. The earth became a submerged chaos. And you had a judgment. And God began to do a work. He created a species of creature called man. And he created man to have dominion on the earth. And the serpent, we know the account in chapter 3, the serpent comes and he engages Adam in a conflict, really, of wisdom. And Adam succumbs and surrenders the earth to the adversary. And it's interesting because Satan's thinking is, God wants to defeat me with these things? I mean, think about that. It was easy. So all through the book of Genesis, God begins to do a work focused on the earth. He begins to work through a guy called Abraham to give him possession of the land. And he's selecting a particular son from Abraham and Sarah. And they're to possess the land. He selects a particular son of Isaac's, not his oldest, but his youngest. And he wants to give him the land. You have 12 sons of Jacob. And again, he wants to give them the land. And all through the book of Genesis, there's this focus that becomes more and more narrow, the land with a particular group of people that would take over that land, that would have possession of that land, the land of Palestine, and eventually it would be called the land of Israel. And God's focus was single-minded. He becomes more and more narrow, not him, but him, not him, but him. Not this group of people that's in the land, but this group of people I'm going to bring into the land. And all of his focus and all of his energy is to the land. And by the time we hit here in Deuteronomy before they go into the land, Moses here is communicating some things. And what Moses says is that God's plan is to bring the days of heaven on the earth. That's his focus. Everything is the earth. In the land, and the people that are going to possess that land, I'm going to give them my law. My righteousness is going to be displayed through my law. And he's focusing all of his energy and all of his work on the earth, in Israel, in the land. So Satan begins to look at it. And he goes, God's so concerned with that group of people, then I'm going to be concerned on making sure that people doesn't get entrenched into the land. So you have this conflict that begins to ensue. You have brief moments where the conflict becomes intense, like the Tower of Babel. If God's focus is on the land, on the earth, well, I'm going to do something on the earth to build a tower where they can worship me. That results in Abraham, right? God gets more specific. You have where God is concerned with Israel, and Satan becomes concerned with the Canaanites. And they're at animosity with one another. And there's conflict. And all through the Pentateuch, this conflict runs. The days of heaven on earth. But it's interesting because this conflict runs all through the Jewish writings. It doesn't end once Israel comes into the land. Because Satan keeps raising up false gods through different Gentile nations to have a conflict to take possession of the land. His focus is earth. His focus is the land. His focus is eradicating God's people, Israel. His focus is to set up another religious system. His focus is to have his armies destroy Israel, to have his religious system come in and corrupt God's system. He did a good job of it with the Israel, the northern tribes, as they implemented a false religious worship that was a hybrid of the religions of that land and Yahwehism. So you have all this conflict. Now, it's interesting. It reaches a crescendo when Jesus Christ is born. Right? Just think of some of the things you read in the four evangels. The land was overflowing with demonic hosts. Remember the account of Legion? Mm-hmm. Right? One man possessed by a legion of demons. That's a pretty significant thing, I think. And it's interesting because when God, through Jesus Christ, is looking at it, and Legion's there, and he's about to cast Legion out, they ask, let us stay in the land. Cast us into the swine. Their concern isn't necessarily who they're possessing. Their concern is being in the land. Why? Because God's doing something with the land. The Lord, when he was teaching his disciples how to pray, remember the Lord's Prayer? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come on earth. Down here to planet Earth. The focus is planet Earth. And it's interesting. Moses writes, some things. God communicating to mankind through Moses. And Moses' focus is how to be a righteous people on the earth. How to go into a kingdom on the earth. How to have the nations of the earth come to a knowledge of who God is. His focus is narrow-minded. His focus is on a specific strip of land on planet Earth. And it gets more and more narrow. It goes from all of Israel and becomes more narrow, the city of Jerusalem. So you have all of this going on, and what I'm going to submit is this is a type of God's plan. He's doing a misdirect. Satan is focused on the earth. Now, if we went into the book of Joshua again and we looked at the account, everything ensues just like God said it would to Joshua. Israel has its troops in behind. Ai sends its army out. A battle ensues. They flee and they continue to pursue. The troops that are in behind Ai come in, take the city. Then they come out of the city and you have Ai's army trapped between two forces, and it's destroyed. It's obliterated. And the best thing, because this city here was alive, you have a camp that's over here that just moves right in and takes that city very easily as well. Pretty cool thing. So all of this is going on. And all of it's pretty significant. And all of it is something that, on the surface, it looks like Satan is winning the war. You have God begin to focus on a throne, a particular king, a particular line coming from David. Solomon, Rehoboam, and it continues down. The genealogies are to prove that Jesus has a claim to the throne of David. One of the genealogies is his claim through his father, through his stepdad, Joseph. And the other genealogy is his claim through his mother, Mary. And both of them prove that Jesus has a claim to the throne. He comes to be a king. He claims to be the Messiah. It's interesting. In Luke, if you want to turn to Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1. Verse 30. Luke 1, verse 30. We're going to read down through verse 33. And the messenger said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with Elohim. And behold, you shall be conceiving and be pregnant and be bearing forth a son, and shall be calling his name Jesus. This one shall be great and shall be named the son of Elion. And Yahweh Elohim shall give to him the throne of his father David. And he shall rule over the house of Jacob for the eons. And of his government there shall be no consummation." Now it's interesting because when you read through that, you have this idea, as Mary has just found out that she's going to conceive a child, that the focus that is communicated to her is that he is going to have a government. He's going to be on a throne. And the throne is of his father David. God's focus in the evangels is the earth. Remember when he communicates, when Jesus communicates with Nicodemus? Go with me for a second to John 3. I want to look at something kind of interesting there. John chapter 3. Look at verse 12. And in verse 12 it says, "If you are not believing when I told you of the terrestrial, how shall you be believing if I should be telling you of the apocryphal or celestial?" Now, it's interesting. That whole communication with Nicodemus was focusing on what? According to that verse.
The terrestrial.
It had nothing to do with the heavens. That idea of being born again has nothing to do with heaven other than the fact that he's giving information on how they would establish the days of heaven on earth. Why is it that Israel needed all the healing and all of those different miracles that would come with it? Because they're physical. They live on a physical world in a physical planet where there's physical illnesses. So what do? You eliminate the illness by allowing healing so that they can function on planet Earth. Not too hard. His focus is on the Earth. All through these accounts, go to Luke chapter 19. Luke 19, and let's look at verse 11. Luke 19, verse 11. While the people were listening to these things, Jesus proceeded to tell a parable because it was near to Jerusalem. And because they thought that the government of Elohim was going to appear immediately. How was it that they understood these things? That the government, or most translations will render kingdom. Some will translate it as reign, like the Weymouth translation, for instance, the reign of heaven. The idea here is that they were looking and anticipating that a government would be set up immediately. And it's interesting, where is he? Near Jerusalem. The focus is on planet Earth. The focus is on the people that are going to rule on planet Earth. Who are they? Israel. Doesn't Jesus promised to the 12 apostles that they would be on 12 thrones, ruling over the 12 tribes of Israel. The focus was the earth. How was he going to rule? If you go back into the Sermon on the Mount, you have where Jesus gives you how it is he's going to rule. What does he do? He takes the law of Moses and he intensifies it. John touched on this yesterday. It's not adultery anymore just to do the act. It's adultery to even think about doing the act. He takes it from action and puts it even into the thoughts. He makes it more difficult, not easier. He intensifies the law in that regard. And it's interesting, when you read that Sermon on the Mount, how many times he'll say, "It has been said of old, yet I say unto you." And what he does is he takes an old covenant principle, makes it more difficult to keep it, and intensifies it, and that's the new principle by how he's going to govern. Now, all through these things, he sits. It's interesting, even in the Sermon on the Mount, where is he? He's sitting in a mountain, like a king, making kingly decrees. He's recognized by those who follow him as the rightful ruler. They think that the government, the kingdom, is being established at any moment. He's here on earth. But because he's here on earth, and because he's so near to Jerusalem, guess who else comes down the planet earth? The adversary. And what is the adversary doing? Well, there's this fellow that's one of the 12 apostles, right? Named Judas Iscariot. And what happens with Judas Iscariot? Well, later on you read that he is actually indwelt by Satan. Satan enters into him, and we all know the account. He sells Jesus out for 30 pieces of silver, the price of a slave. Silver, by the way, is what the currency is for redemption. Kind of an interesting thing. And he focuses on getting rid of his challenger to the rulership of planet Earth. That's what he does. He goes, this guy Jesus is here. He's going to be a king. Indwells Judas, orchestrates his arrest. And at his crucifixion, he uses his main instrument, the religious leaders of Israel, to call for his crucifixion and to get rid of his challenger once and for all. Something happens he doesn't anticipate, though. Once he got rid of him, he came back from the dead. And what's he begin to do? Well, on the road to Emmaus, he runs into a couple people, begins to talk with them, talks to his apostles, and he tells them all the things in the Old Testament about himself concerning how he's going to establish a government on planet Earth, and tells them, I want you to begin to do these things because my Spirit's going to come and it's going to fill you and you're going to possess planet Earth. He picks up where he left off and his communication is planet Earth. His focus is on establishing a government in Jerusalem on planet Earth. But then he leaves. And you have the apostles that are there. And what Satan's looking at it is, I beat him because it's not taking root. In Acts chapter 3, there's a bona fide offer of a kingdom to come, and they reject it. And it culminates in chapter number 7 with the stoning of Stephen. And Satan goes, I've won! He beat a retreat back into the heavens. I have possession of the earth. And guess what happens? The trap gets sprung. This is the good news, guys. What happens is that God has Jesus Christ appear to his chief enemy, a guy by the name of Saul of Tarsus. And when he appears to Saul of Tarsus, he asks Saul of Tarsus, why do you persecute me? And he begins to communicate a body of information to Saul of Tarsus that no man had ever heard before. A body of information on how God's not going to declare somebody righteous through the works of the law, but he's going to declare a person righteous through the work of his son. Here, when he was crucified. It's not going to be based off of your righteousness. It's based off the righteousness of my son. It's not based off of the law. I'm extending grace. It's not based off of you performing. It's based off the fact you can't perform. That's pretty exciting. He's raising up a new entity, something that never before existed, something brand new, a new species of creatures. If you go with me to Ephesians chapter number 4, Ephesians 4, verse 8. It says here, therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave endowments to men. Now, what is the meaning of he ascended except that he also descended to the lower regions, namely the land? He, the very one who descended, is also the one who ascended above all the heavens in order to fill all things. The idea is he came down to planet Earth, he came down here, and he led the captives free. To lead captivity captive is to take something that's not yours and parade them throughout all your enemies that I have conquered you. Who were the enemies of God? The Gentile nations. What did he do? He came down, and now through what the Apostle Paul has revealed, he begins to operate with the people who were aligned with Satan. Who are they? The Gentiles. What does he do? He's leading them captive. In Colossians, it talks about making a spoil of them. A spoil is taking the possessions of your opponent and making them yours. He spoiled the Gentile nations. He took those who were against him, and now they are for him. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? His trap was, I'm going to use the people you're using to try to destroy me, and I'm going to take those very people, and they are going to be your undoing. He communicates to that people a new message, a message of grace, a message that God is going to reconcile them. God is going to, he has already redeemed them. God is going to elevate them. God is going to place them into the celestial realm, and they are going to rule and reign in the celestials with a message that never before had existed. Not a message of condemnation, but a message of liberation. A message of freedom. A message whereby those who were enslaved and under the bondage of sin were now being set free because sin isn't the issue anymore. I dealt with it. I was the offering for it. I was the sacrifice for it. And it was perfect. And it removed sin from the equation. The Gentile nations now became the entity whereby God began the deal. Today, there's no exalted nation. Today, God's not dealing with nations. He's dealing with individuals. There's no exalted people today. Israel is Laomai, aren't they? They're not God's people. There's neither Jew nor Greek. In other words, I'm not concerned about ethnicity anymore. You want to get to God, it doesn't matter whether you're circumcised or not. It's not the issue anymore. I'm dealing with you in a totally different way. I'm dealing with you based off of what my son accomplished. I'm dealing you through the writings of a different apostle. I'm not dealing with you based off of Moses and his writings. I'm dealing with you based off of what the apostle Paul wrote, something that was called unsearchable, untraceable, something that was unknown. Why? Because I kept it a secret until I gave it to him. Go with me here while we're in Ephesians, back to chapter 3. Paul writes here, verse 1, "Because of this, I, Paul, the prisoner of Messiah Jesus, on behalf of you, the Gentiles, since you surely hear of the dispensation of the favor of Elohim, which has been given to me for you." Now let me stop there. That word dispensation simply means to dispense. We think of a pharmacy as a dispensary, right? Mm-hmm. It's a dispensing. It's an economy. What's the economy? The economy is the grace of God. He says that what was given to him was this dispensation. He says in verse 3, "For by an unveiling, the mystery or secret is made known to me," the Apostle Paul, "according as I wrote before in brief, so that while each of you read, you may be able to understand my knowledge of the mystery or secret of the Messiah or Christ, which in other generations was not made known to the sons of men, as it is now unveiled to his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit, namely, those in Messiah Jesus, the Gentiles, are co-heirs, companions, and co-partners in the promise. Such is the evangel which I was invited into to serve by the endowment of Elohim's favor or grace, which was bestowed to me by the energy of his power. To me, the last and the least of all saints, was given this favor or grace among the Gentiles to proclaim the evangel, the unsearchable riches of the Messiah." Verse 9, "to enlighten all on what is the dispensation of the mystery that has been hid from the eons in Elohim, who the all things did create by Jesus Messiah, so that by means of the ecclesia, us, the multifarious wisdom of Elohim might become known to the principalities and authorities that are in celestials." Here's the idea. Jesus leaves. Satan's focus is on planet Earth. All of his forces are on planet Earth. As Satan is here on planet Earth thinking he's won a great victory, God from heaven, through his Son, reveals a new body of information that takes those that were aligned with Satan, makes them his, and elevates them into the celestial realm that he vacated. And guess what? The heavens are no longer under his control. Why? They're under ours. The principalities and powers, all that government that was in the celestial realm, is learning the wisdom of God through us. The misdirect. I sucked you in, just like at AI, and I sprang a trap, and what was once yours is now mine. And guess what? You can't win now. Why? Because I still have a group of people here on planet Earth I'm going to deal with. I have a group of people in the heavens I'm going to deal with, and they are going to squeeze you into defeat. And he's a beaten opponent. And he knows it. It's an incredible thing when you begin to see how he just turned the tables. In Corinthians, it says that none of the princes of this world would have crucified Christ had they known what the end result was. You know who the chief prince of this world is?
Adversary.
The adversary. He didn't figure it out. He was taken in his own trap. What he thought was his victory, the crucifixion of Christ, became his defeat. That's exciting, folks. Not only is it exciting, but it lays out that God has a twofold purpose, a twofold plan. An earthly plan, a heavenly plan, an earthly group of people he's working with called Israel, a heavenly group of people he's working with called the body of Christ. The two work for the same sign, but they're not the same. They're two different entities with two different realms that they operate in, with two different messages, with two different aspects of what God is doing. Both glorious, both righteous, but different. And the problem with most people in Christendom is that they try to take both plans and mesh them together, and they create confusion. They create things that just aren't so. You get people clinging to promises that aren't theirs, and then when the promises don't come, they throw up their hands and say, "What's the point?" I remember talking with somebody one time, and they were waiting to be healed. It was when I was going through cancer treatments, and I was sitting there, this person getting a drip while they're getting a drip. And the person goes, "You know, I used to be a staunch Christian." And I said, "Well, why aren't you anymore?" And they go, "Because God had said if I named something and claimed it, that he'd give it to me, and I named and I claimed that I would be healed, and it hasn't happened." And he said, "Did you ever stop to think that maybe God's not doing that now?" And we began to have a discussion. This person's faith was shipwrecked because he took something that belonged to a different group of people under a different economy, under a different marching orders, with a different purpose and a different goal, and he was trying to claim their promises as his own, and what ended up is his faith became shipwrecked. And it's not just this person. Literally, there's hundreds and thousands of people that over and over again say, "Christendom doesn't work because God said he'd do this and he hasn't done it, and therefore it's a bunch of fairy tales." The problem is they're trying to take something that was never given to them and make it their own. And it doesn't work. You want to know what God's doing today? You're only going to find that through the pen of the Apostle Paul. You want to know how he's operating today? He's only operating through the grace of God. Without the works of righteousness or the works of the law, based on faith in what his Son accomplished. That's how he's operating. He wants you to live to the status he's given you. What are you? An adopted son of God who can't merit anything. And I rest in what God has accomplished because his Son can accomplish anything. And he's given it to me freely. We're not a spiritual Israel. We're not Israel. We're the body of Christ. The two are not the same. They're different. We function in the celestials. If you're claiming earthly promises, it's not what God's doing. They don't work because he never gave those to you. They were never intended for you. Let's keep things where they are and realize the victory's won. We have it. We are more than conquerors. What Romans 8 says. We are more than conquerors. Why? Because we're rulers. We rule. We reign. We're co-heirs. We are the sons of God. That's who we are. That's a good place to be.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Bill.
I told you it was a football play. The flea flicker.
Flea flicker. There you go.
All right, about 10 minutes, about 5 after, we'll get started again.
Let's see.